com, Facebook, The Diabetic Show. If you ever hear about Dobie Maxwell out and about doing something, go see the guy.
It's only a misdemeanor.
That's true. Have yourself a great time.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW-Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
This program originally aired May 17th, 2014.
Good morning. I'm Steve Brown, your host today for Education Matters. May 17th, 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court announced its decision in the landmark case of Brown versus the Board of Education. And today marks the 60th anniversary of the Brown v. Board decision. On May 17th of 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the separate but equal doctrine in American public education. This 11-page decision, much shorter than other major decisions of the era and written by Chief Justice Earl Warren, is unemotional, was firm, and it was clear when it said, "We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal." This decision was unanimous, but the reaction around the country was not. I'm very pleased today to have as my exclusive guest here on Education Matters, Cheryl Brown Henderson, the daughter of Oliver L. Brown, after whom the case of Brown v. Board et al. Is named. And just for transparency purposes, we are taping this on May the 3rd and, of course, broadcasting it on May the 17th. And Cheryl, this is 60 years to the date when Brown versus the Board of Education was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, isn't it?
It is. May 17th, 1954, Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren announced to the nation and the world their decision in Brown v. Board.
As you look back at those early years, I mean, you were barely 4 years old. You were three and a half years old or so. But what are some of your own earliest recollections about the case?
Well, my recollections about the case came, of course, in the aftermath and when the nation started waking up to its significance and its impact. And the first recollection, I was 9 years old, and we were living in Springfield, Missouri. My father was an African Methodist Episcopal minister, and the AME church moves their pastors around, you know, as they ascend through the ranks of the ministry. And we had been relocated to Springfield, Missouri in 1959. And upon our arrival, the local newspaper came and did a nice story about our family being new to Springfield and about our family's connection to Brown versus the Board of Education. So I was a glimmer, you know, not really understanding fully at 9 years old, but certainly recognized that there was some uniqueness to that history.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second recollection was after my father passed away. He passed away in 1961, died of a heart attack, and we relocated, mother and the three of us girls, back to Topeka. And that 3 years later, in 1964, for the 10th anniversary of Brown v. Board, I was coming home from junior high school and noticed a stranger on the front porch. And we lived in an integrated neighborhood, so it wasn't uncommon to see people of other races and ethnicities at our home. So this particular day, the white gentleman on the porch I didn't recognize as being someone in the community. So when I got closer to him and he noticed I was a little reluctant to approach, he stuck out his hand and said, "Hi, My name is Charles Carroll, and I'm here taping a show called On the Road with Charles Carroll. And they were there for the 10th anniversary of Brown v. Board. So, you know, that was probably another very early recollection of the aftermath, the significance, and how the country was beginning to focus on the people involved, as well as what difference the case would make for the nation.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've heard you say in some speeches, when you talk about the case, Brown versus the Board of Education et al., and you emphasize those two words, et al. And one of the things that I always find interesting, Cheryl, because I, as you know, I teach school law, is that there are so many people, and regardless of their own educational background, really don't know that Brown versus the Board of Education was really made up of five cases. And I just wonder, when you say those two words et al., do you sometimes get strange expressions from people?
No, because one of the missions, my family and others, we've made it our mission to convey to audiences, both in our writing and in our lectures, the definition of et al. Most people are not familiar with legal terminology at all. So it's certainly to get them to understand, you have to first start with the definition of et al., meaning and others. There are two sets of et al. That are part of the Brown decision. The legal citation is Oliver L. Brown et al. Versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas et al. The first set of et al.s are the plaintiffs in Topeka, who were companion plaintiffs along with my father. There were 13 parents who were plaintiffs on behalf of their children, and that represented a total of 20 children. At the end of that, the additional et al. Refers to the companion cases that the United States Supreme Court rolled in with Brown v. Board. Actually, because all of those cases were seeking the same remedy, the Supreme Court heard them as a group and provided that umbrella name of Brown v. Board of Education to reference all of the cases.
Mm-hmm. Before we kind of drill down into the case, maybe if you could talk briefly for our listening audience how your father got directly involved in the case, because I think it's very interesting, and it's probably something that many people don't know about.
Now, all of the litigants, all of the plaintiffs, I'll put it that way, that were involved in the cases, both the Kansas case, the Delaware case, Virginia, South Carolina, and Washington, D.C. cases, were individuals who were recruited. I'll make one exception, the Virginia case we'll talk about in a moment. But the other four cases were all made up of families that were recruited by the local NAACP. So in Topeka, the NAACP, led by McKinley Burnett, who was the president at the time, really wanted to figure out a way to finally put to rest this notion of it being legal and constitutional to segregate public schools. And in doing so, they needed to have plaintiffs, and they needed families with elementary-age children, since in Kansas, it was elementary schools that were legally segregated. So in really focusing on how would they assemble this group of people, the Legal Redress Committee for the NAACP came up with the idea of putting together a recruitment strategy. So they spent the summer of 1950 going around the community, talking to churches, talking to neighbors and friends, trying to come up with a group of people that would be the plaintiffs in this class action that they were putting together. So one of the people on the Legal Redress Committee, Charles Scott Sr., had grown up with my dad. They were childhood friends. So it was very natural, I think, for Charles Scott to think of his friend, Oliver, who at the time had one school-age child, my older sister, Linda, and then during the court proceedings, we had a second school-age child, my sister Terry. So he came to our home, you know, out of friendship, and asked my father if he would consider joining the list of the roster of plaintiffs that they were putting together. By the time they asked my father, however, they had nine parents who had agreed to be plaintiffs for this case. My father became the 10th parent, and then they continued on with their recruitment, ending up with 13 parents who had said yes, that they would be willing to be plaintiffs on behalf of their minor children. So he really got involved by a very direct request on the part of his friend who was an attorney for the NAACP.
As you look back at the case and all of the people who were involved in all five of the cases, certainly there were many who played a major role. And you were talking about, at least in four of the cases, that there were, you know, those individuals were recruited. In that fifth case, in the Virginia case, a really interesting story. And I know oftentimes you talk about all the heroes who have been involved in the fight for equality in our country. And perhaps we could chat a bit about Barbara Johns. I mean, it's a remarkable story. She was a remarkable person. And maybe if we could talk a bit about Barbara Johns.
Barbara was remarkable because the interesting thing, Stephen, is with the type of Jim Crow and the type of segregation that was practiced in the South, you know, it was so ever-present. But at a very young age, I think African-American children became aware of what they were experiencing, what their families were experiencing, what they were experiencing. And Barbara Johns was uniquely impacted by that. You know, she recognized at a very early age that their school, you know, was not on par with school that white children attended. She recognized that the textbooks that they were using to learn from were inadequate in that they were missing pages and they were hand-me-downs. She recognized that the facilities, because it was an overcrowded school, the school built for a little over 100 students, now was bursting at the seams with over 400 students. So to address that, the school district built a set of tar paper buildings behind the school, and there were even classes held on the school bus. So she recognized that all of this was clearly, you know, separate and unequal. And in that recognition, and Barbara was on the debate team, so she was no stranger to how to use the spoken word, but she made up her mind that things had to change. And in order for that to happen, she would work with her sister, her fellow students, and they would strike. They would go on strike. They would do something very visible, you know, very action-oriented to call attention to what they knew was not right. And Barbara, at 16 years old, and her fellow strike leaders hatched a plan, a very, very intelligent and elaborate plan, if you will, mm-hmm. because one of the strike participants was a young man named John Watson. And John Watson, who's a radio personality in Delaware, now retiring, but he had an amazing voice even then. It was clear that he had a radio presence. So they recruited him to place a call to the principal, because he could sound like an adult male, you know, indicating that there was a ruckus downtown and some of your boys were having a problem and you need to come down and take care of it. He was convincing, and it got the principal out of the building so that their plan could unfold. Barbara and her strikers had put together a memo asking the teachers to send their students to the auditorium at a certain time. So they really thought this through. This was well crafted and executed. So once they succeeded and got Boy James out of the building and the teachers sent their students to the auditorium, then the real drama ensued when the curtains opened and there stood 16-year-old Barbara Johns, with everybody in the audience really perplexed and wondering, you know, what on earth? And her sister, Joan Johns Cobbs, who's still living and is a friend of mine, talks about how she really was so embarrassed that she started sliding down in her seat that her big sister Barbara was on the stage. Oh, my goodness. And then, of course, as you and I know, Stephen, Barbara launched into her speech to the students mm-hmm. about the inequality and how they needed to really take some action and that she was organizing a strike. And then she laid out the details for that strike and the rest, as they say, is history, but monumental action on the part of a 16-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, after that strike, her parents did fear for her safety, didn't they? And I believe they sent her to Alabama.
It was a common practice when the Ku Klux Klan was very active in this country. You know, we know about its Ohio roots, but we also Indiana roots, but it was also everywhere. You know, Kansas was no exception. But in the South, they were particularly active and very overt, and it made it quite clear that because of the actions of these students led by Barbara Johns, that her life was something that they believed should be taken. You know, that there had been word that a contract even had been put out on her life. Now, you have to realize that the Johns family came from decades of activism. Her uncle, Vernon Johns of Montgomery, Alabama, had been the pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, which is the church upon Reverend Johns' retirement. It's the church that Reverend Martin Luther King became the pastor. And that was his move into the South, a return to the South, was to Montgomery as the pastor of Dexter Avenue. So their family was steeped in activism, and Barbara was really part of that continuum, if you will. But yes, she was moved out of the county for her safety.
As you travel around the country, and as you have many questions asked of you, or if you read things, as you read things, in particular on the internet about the case, and I know you've commented, I've heard you comment, there are so many inaccurate things said about Brown versus the Board of Education. What are some of the more just outrageous things that you have heard or read about that people just write or say about the case that are absolutely not true?
Well, you know, I'm really thrilled for this opportunity because the internet is oftentimes the very first place students go when they're researching a topic these days. And there are many, many, many websites that presume to be the experts on Brown versus the Board of Education. And some of those websites we've run across. And we became aware of some of them because of questions we were getting from students that were working on school projects that would contact us. And some of the more outrageous that we've become aware of and actually run across ourselves was that our family was chosen because we were the only intact family with a mom and a dad. And that's not true. Every single family was a mom and a dad and children. These were quintessential 1950s households, so without exception. So I think it's really kind of frustrating when people impose certain stereotypes that perhaps African-American families are always led by moms without a father present. That's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
So that's outrageous. The other outrageous assertion was, and perhaps maybe not so outrageous, that my father was a World War II veteran and came back, you know, incensed that a nation he had fought for would be mired in this segregation and Jim Crow. And my father could not serve in the military. He was born with an enlarged heart and had heart disease all his life, and that's what finally killed him. So he could not be in the military. So someone just made the leap, you know, and placed him there. Another assertion was that he was on his own, had traveled to New York and sought out Thurgood Marshall. And my father never met Justice Marshall, never met Attorney Marshall at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's interesting that they would place him when the two men never met, yet they were creating this mythical meeting. And then the assertion that he was born in Maryland, and I think, again, they're getting that confused with Thurgood Marshall, who was, in fact, born in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those kinds of things are, you know, they're troubling, to say the least, because miseducating and misinforming, when the opportunity to have the facts, it's a little stressful for our family, and we try as best we can to correct whenever we run across something.
Back in February of 2009, when Attorney General Eric Holder gave a speech at the Department of Justice, he said this: though this nation has proudly thought of itself as an ethnic melting pot, in things racial, we have always been and continue to be, in too many ways, essentially a nation of cowards. That sort of parallels comment that you made back in 2004 in a PBS NewsHour interview when you said that we need to start talking about issues about racism, segregation, discrimination, and second-class citizenship in our country. I guess my question for you, Cheryl, is, I guess it's a two-pronged question. Why is it that so many people have such difficulty and refuse to really talk about issues of race, and in particular about racism in our country?
Well, I think it's twofold. First of all, there are people in our country who are white, whose families have been very active around the issues of civil rights and around the issues of, you know, ending practices that would deny people of color and women, you know, opportunities. They're that segment. So the white majority is not monolithic. Not all of them feel as though they are superior. You know, white supremacy is not something that permeates the white community as a whole. However, there is still a reluctance to take on even one another. I mean, that those dialogues should be taking place in white neighborhoods, and they should be talking to one another about their feelings around issues of race and around issues of immigration, which I think is fueled by, you know, racism, if you will. So those conversations are not taking place. And then you add to that having the conversation with the people in question. So if we're talking about the continuation of discrimination against whether it be Mexican Americans or people of Muslim faith or African Americans, you know, the only way you get beyond that is to put it out there. What is your concern? What is it that really challenged you when it comes to recognizing another group's right to citizenship and another group's right to employment and housing and you know, all of the facets of society? You know, what is it that keeps you thinking that somehow, you know, there are certain groups that simply do not have the right? And I think until we talk about that in an honest way, that Attorney General Holder was right, that the cowardice comes from people know what they think and people know what they feel, but seldom outside of maybe a friend's ear, seldom is that conveyed in a setting where it could make a real difference, where it could make an impact on public policy or an impact on some of the debates that we're having even at the Supreme Court level. So I think that's what he meant. And race will always matter because it's how we identify ourselves. I've just finished filling out my Census Bureau form. And race matters. You know, they ask very poignant questions around issues that identify race. So I don't see that ever being something that won't matter because it's self-identification. Mm-hmm. And it's part of our identity. And there's nothing wrong with that. So to try to demonize the idea that race matters is, I think, very short-sighted.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us here on Education Matters today, my guest is Cheryl Brown Henderson, and we're talking about Brown versus the Board of Education in recognition of the 60th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision back in May of 1954. Cheryl, the preamble to our Constitution starts with, "We, the people of the United States." You have said that "we, the people," never really meant people of color or women or disabled or the aged. Do you think that was purposely done? Do you think that was something that was actually meant to happen, or do you think it just happened on its own?
I think it happened on its own because the people that were putting together those founding documents were not exposed to. You know, they didn't recognize that slavery would end. They didn't recognize it when slavery ended and after the Civil War that Congress, who could have really envisioned that Congress would and the states would ratify the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. That was something clearly not on anybody's radar, and certainly they could not have been anticipated at that point. So I think it happened naturally that there was a presumption that our nation would always look like it looked at that time, where there would be the founding fathers, as they call them, you know, white males who were landowner, people of means and money, would be always setting the pace, and in many ways they are. But I guess they didn't envision that they would have to share and that people of color, people who are older, women, would fight mm-hmm. for the right to work alongside them, you know, in forming this union. They didn't anticipate that.
Cheryl, changing gears for a moment, the national uproar recently with Mr. Bundy out in Las Vegas or Donald Sterling with his racist comments, who is the owner of the L.A. Clippers. Were you surprised at all at the national uproar that this whole thing has caused?
No, I don't. And this is first of all, let's go with Mr. Bundy. Mr. Bundy interjected these conversations. So he, having cattle, you know, grazing on public lands and not honoring the agreement that grazing fees would be paid in his own way, was receiving a subsidy and actively pursuing that subsidy by not paying the grazing fee. And basically then his the grazing of his cattle was being subsidized by all of us. That's number one. So for him to inject this idea that he ran across a group of African Americans standing outside of what he described as a public housing project in Las Vegas, and that he would ponder, you know, have they nothing to do. And he would further ponder that they have nothing to do because they didn't learn how to pick cotton. And if they had known how to pick cotton and were still slaves, you know, they would at least have family time and things to do. You know, first of all, we cannot give reason to the rants of Mr. Bundy. And I consider it eloquent ignorance, if you will, because on its face, it makes no sense. And then he goes on to say that, you know, what did they gain? They gained no freedom. They have less freedom. So first of all, you have to question, why did he feel compelled to interject that into a dialogue about his failure to pay grazing fees? You know, that the two of them had nothing to do with one another. And yet no one challenged him on his suggestion that African Americans were receiving subsidies. That was part of his diatribe, where he himself had been actively pursuing and receiving subsidized grazing. So a lot of these things, I think, are statements to deflect, if you will. And it, when a person gets a national platform like Mr. Bundy found himself having, you know, then they also try to use it as a way to speak things that have been in their minds and in their heart, you know. And I don't know what impact they think they'll have, but they feel as though this is my shot. You know, I'm going to talk about the things I've pondered and this group of people that we're all should be suspect of, and it simply fuels everything. But, yeah, I'm not surprised at the shock because of the nonsensical nature of what he said, and I'm not surprised by the shock because, again, this is a man that had formed a militia and was really expressing anti-government sentiments. So there are a lot of issues rolled into Mr. Bundy's statement.
And then we turn to Donald Sterling. What's your reaction to all of his comments?
Well, again, I mean, they were incongruent. Mr. Sterling, you know, he had has a mistress that is clearly a woman of color, and he owns a team that is predominated by men of color. His income is derived from that team, and he's also known for denying people access to housing, you know, that he owns based on their race and ethnicity. So this is a man, I think, that within himself, there's a lot of ambivalence. You know, on one hand, you happily earn a living from the labor and the play of these African-American players. You enjoy the company of your mistress of color. They'll let you espouse these views. So, you know, it always strikes me as being incongruent. It strikes me as being disingenuous. You know, we've always been a nation that, whose cowardice leads us to want to have it both ways. You know, and I reflect often in my lectures about Strom Thurmond, who we learned before her passing had this African-American daughter that he supported financially and knew and spent time with. You know, yet publicly he was a segregationist. So I don't know why, you know, after all these years. And look at Thomas Jefferson, you know, and Sally Hemings. I mean, people have always lived this dichotomy when it comes to race. And they pick and choose, you know, when they want to be segregationist. They pick and choose when they want to represent themselves in a certain way. I don't see that that's all that different now.
Well, and that leads me, I mean, that's a perfect lead-in to the question, how do we, how can we fight racism? There's overt racism in this country. oftentimes is covert, and many times it's overt. How do we fight it?
Well, I have to be honest. I'm fearful, and I'm fearful because the place we were able to go in the past to have our constitutional rights protected, to have an interpretation that would result in legislation to modulate some of this behavior, because you can legislate behavior. The U.S. Supreme Court, I'm fearful when decisions coming out of the court really start rolling back some of the protections and some of the gains that we as people of color had.
Mm-hmm.
The hearts and minds of people, that's the kind of work that dialogue can address. But legal issues, whether court decisions or legislation, at least provides us with some protection, if you will. You look at the young men that have been murdered, you know, in the last decade, unarmed young men. The young man in the vestibule of New York, you know, you look at the young man down in Texas, James Byrd. You look at what happened in the Gina Six. You look at the young man recently, the Loud Music case, and
mm-hmm.
then the young man, which we'll never know what happened, walking in a neighborhood in Florida.
Right.
So, you know, I'm fearful. I'm fearful because the verdict in these cases generally absolve the person who's taken the life. And with that kind of move, it not only devalues, which we as African Americans always lived in fear, you know, that our lives were of less value when it comes to the judicial process. You know, that only makes it, when it's high profile, as I call it, it makes it open season.
Mm-hmm.
And when those things happen, you know, rightfully so, we do become fearful. So my concern is that somehow the courts, the judicial system, the Supreme Court, our legislative branch, need to wake up. And perhaps the dialogue about racism and second-class citizenship and discrimination and disparities in sentencing, the dialogue needs to take place there in the halls of Congress, you know, in the chambers of our Supreme Court justices. Because those are the folks that can set, and even in the Oval Office, you know, those are the folks that really can set the agenda and set the pace for our nation. We've had an opportunity, so many opportunities. You know, the Dred Scott case. We had an opportunity with Plessy v. Ferguson. We had an opportunity with Brown v. Bourdieu. We have these opportunities, and yet we haven't seized them in a way that would say to this country, from the Oval Office, you know, from the halls of Congress, that this idea of segregation, discrimination, bias, white supremacy stops now. No one's given that kind of definitive
edict. Cheryl, with the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision on affirmative action where they're leaving it up to the states, are we turning the clock back when it comes to issues related to affirmative action and issues like that?
Absolutely. And you look at parents involved in community schools out of Washington State, it rolled in with the case from Virginia, where voluntary integration or desegregation was struck down. So absolutely we're turning back. If you can't voluntarily, you know, if your school district can't come up with a voluntary plan that would be accepted by the court, there's something wrong with that. So, yes, we're absolutely turning back the clock. And, again, I go back to the idea of fear. I go back to the idea of the harm being done. I go back to the idea of opportunity being lost. Yes, we are. And then people will ask the question. Now, why do we still have historically black colleges and universities? Well, I think the court answered that question. I think the parents involved in community schools answered that question. Now, if we're going to have an opportunity to compete and have the kind of education that will prepare us to compete, and the majority in this country is working to see to it that at every turn doesn't happen, then yes, we need to have places like HBCUs where those opportunities, where that education can take place. I mean, it's really sad but true. I also think that we need to be concerned about educating the children where we find them. While the courts are battling, while school boards are battling, while people are struggling with this whole idea of schools being predominated by black and brown children, you know, that doesn't let you off the hook. That the color of the child doesn't mean you don't educate them. So regardless of who's in that school, that people have to be accountable. have to come out learning, knowing how to read, you know, coming out with math proficiency and English proficiency. So there's no excuse. I think we scapegoat our children and impose adult problems on them. And then when they turn out frustrated, angry, and turning to criminality and other areas that we frown on, you know, then we point the finger at them when we've created this structure.
And my next to last question is, the Brown decision happened 60 years ago on this date that this program is airing. Where do you think we will be in terms of integrated education and other important issues that relate to equality in this country that were raised by the Brown v. Board case in the next 60 years or in the next, let's just say in the next 10 years?
Well, the quote that you attributed to me was really reading from the Supreme Court's decision about education being the most important function of state and local government. It's part of the multi-page decision.
Mm-hmm.
So the decision went beyond the statement of, you know, in the field of public education, we believe separate but equal has no place. There are many statements made in that decision read by Earl Warren, and the one about education being the most important function happens to be the one that I believe is the most compelling. I think where we're going is we're starting to more and more address zip code and economic public school disparities. My state of Kansas, our governor just signed a bill that the Supreme Court had directed that in order to equalize spending across the state in our school systems, that the state had to really set aside more money and to equalize it so that we don't have wealthy districts with every advantage possible, and then we have rural, small, and urban districts without the kind of tax base that would provide them with state-of-the-art education. So you create these resources whereby you can equalize the opportunity for all students. I think we're going in that direction in the next 10 to 60 years. We're going to see more and more, perhaps even Supreme Court cases that will deal with the issue of funding. Now, when Justice Marshall and Thurgood Marshall and Jack Greenberg and Robert Carter and, you know, the Scotts and Harold Bulward, and I could name all the attorneys, but I won't, when they were working on these cases that became Brown v. Board, one of the issues was exactly that, the disparity in funding. It was driven by race, but it was the same thing, that you're spending $4 or $5 per student for African-American students, and yet you're spending maybe $800 to $1,000 on each white student. So in some ways, we're talking about the same challenge, and that is to make certain that the financial resources that prop up our education, our school districts and our schools, and the resources children need to learn are equal for all children. We're still having that debate. So I think that's what's going to take us into the next decade, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Cheryl, is there a section in the Brown v. Board decision that you're the most fond of?
Yes, it's the one you read and I alluded to, that, you know, education is these days, you know, education is the most important function of state and local governments, and that no child can expect to achieve and have any quality of life without the benefit of an education and educational opportunities. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but to me that's the most compelling because it says very clearly to states and to school boards that every child, you know, under your legislative purview as a state legislature, as a state board of education, as a local board of education, you know, is to be educated. Because without that education, there is no opportunity. So, yes, I do think that's more compelling even than in the field of public education.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Separate but equal has no place because we do have separate. Let's face it. And there's no reason why separate can't result in Rhodes Scholars and can't result in students who are accepted to Ivy League colleges. That is inexcusable. I mean, when you're talking about failing underfunded public schools, how can we say that in one sentence when the public pools its money to make certain education and other public public service is provided? So I do think there are a lot of challenges ahead of us. I think funding is going to be one of the huge challenges. I think affirmative action will remain a challenge. But, you know, until we start looking at affirmative action as just one more program that higher education has in place to ensure that students have an opportunity beyond any disadvantage they may bring, It's still not equal. We have legacies. Mm-hmm. Legacies that are either primary legacies, meaning a parent went to that institution, or a legacy, meaning maybe a grandparent went to that institution. You know, a legacy admittance is pretty high. You have a 45% chance of being admitted to that institution if you are a primary legacy. You know, if you have athletic ability, then your chance of being admitted to that university, first of all, people are recruiting you. And you can be a walk-on. You can demonstrate your athletic talent, and you get a leg up in terms of admissions. Certain fields of study are considered in admissions. Certain geographic areas are considered in admissions. So it strikes me as extremely peculiar that we fight so hard against race being considered for admissions. You look at our military academies and other places that have open their doors to women. So now gender is being considered as something to think about when you're being admitted. So anyway, it strikes me that, you know, race should be considered like every other thing I just laid out. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be something so unique and so untenable that it has to be legally set aside and not considered over any other type of condition when admissions to the university is being contemplated.
Mm-hmm. Cheryl, do you ever get tired of talking about Brown v. Board?
I love going out and lecturing because, of course, you're in control of what you say when you do that. Sometimes it's a little stressful when you're having interviews because oftentimes you're asked things perhaps you haven't thought about. You know, you certainly want to come across as being knowledgeable, but this is what strikes me, what's interesting to me, is simply because that monumental Supreme Court decision is named for my father and, mm-hmm. and our family surname. People then presume, you know, that you're going to know it all, and we absolutely don't. You know, you give thought to these things, you read about these things, you form an opinion, but there are so many people, like the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the attorneys there and the attorneys that have been there, like Ted Shaw and Elaine Steele and, you know, our Attorney General Eric Holder and gentleman with the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. I mean, it speaks so eloquently about these issues in very technical ways and very compelling ways that I'm always encouraging people to seek out other people, you know, to talk to with you if you really want to understand this and to get a sense of where our country's going.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Cheryl, you bring, though, such an incredible perspective because you have lived it all of your life. Your name, your family name is on the case, but it's more than just that. You live it, you breathe it. Tell us real quickly about the foundation.
Well, the Brown Foundation was an organization that we started, or is an organization we started in 1988. And we started because every 10 and 5 years, there would be an anniversary of Brown v. Board. And during those anniversaries, we'd sort of take over our lives. You know, the people from the national press would come to our community and they would, you know, call our homes and, you know, it was just taking over our lives. So the decision was if we formed an organization, it would do two things. First of all, it would allow us to hold our legacy, you know, and then secondly, it would allow us to reach out to the plaintiffs from the companion cases and bring everybody under the tent so that the foundation would become a steward of that huge legacy that is Brown v. Board. We're talking several hundred people. We're talking over a dozen attorneys. We're talking community organizers in each location. Every single story is unique and different. Somebody needed to step up to preserve that legacy, to start talking about that legacy, to talk about what happened in South Carolina, tell the story of Barbara John, mm-hmm. talk about Mrs. Beulah in Delaware, and talk about the Bowling case in Washington, D.C. So we did. We set out to preserve that, to be a tribute to the litigants, to the attorneys, to the community organizers, find out who they were, put their names in print, develop curriculum, speak about it, provide teacher workshops, encourage them to speak about their stories. I'm so pleased since 2004 they're now doing. Litigants from the other cases are now talking, lecturing, and writing. So that was the goal, to really bring out of the shadows, if you will, this important case and bring out of the shadows the people who sacrificed greatly. Some of these people lost their homes. They lost their jobs. They were run out of town. Their lives were threatened. You know, fortunately, we didn't have